The Guardian.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition: Mali, high stakes in Hollande's war, Johnny Marr goes solo, and our audiobook review looks at Christopher Priest's The Islanders and Daniel Defoe's classic Robinson Crusoe. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
This is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. Well, we're not going to spend the next half hour banging on about Europe, we promise. But sadly that promise is about as hollow as David Cameron's promise not to bang on about Europe for years on end, as he sets out to embroil himself in a debate he swore to keep out of. We'll look at the context, the timing and the implications of his set-piece speech in the Netherlands on Friday. Also this week, bittersweet Britain. A new survey from the think tank British Future finds that we are bearing up under the strain of economic hardship. And trouble on the streets of Belfast. The dispute over the raising of the Union flag continues to rage across sectarian lines. Joining me to discuss all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Martin Kettle and Gabby Hinsliff, and the director of the British Future think tank, Sundar Katwala. A warm welcome to you all. Now, months of writing, rewriting, wrangling and writhing will culminate on Friday in David Cameron's first major speech on Britain's relationship with the European Union. For generations, Conservatives have known that Europe is a quagmire issue in which their party can easily get stuck. And so David Cameron is determined to avoid raising the issue at all during his leadership, or raising the temperature on it, rather. But events seem to have intervened, and we are now going to get this big speech, much-trailed speech, Martin, on Friday. So it wasn't probably in his grid when he was writing the coalition plan. He didn't think he'd end up making this big speech. So why does he feel that he's going to make it right now?
It's mainly for internal reasons, isn't it? It's mainly for British political reasons. It's mainly because the Tory party and Cameron himself is a fundamentally Eurosceptic party. The old divide between pro and anti-Europe has gone. It's been replaced by a more pragmatic versus rejectionist divide. And the growth of UKIP in the polls has freaked out many Tories, has also provided them with a way of getting excited about the European issue, which has always been the animating question of their politics and of many of the, in the Conservative grassroots. Now, there's a lot of shadows and halls of mirrors in this whole argument, but Cameron is basically doing it because the Tory party requires him to do something about Europe, and obviously Europe is in a mess. That's the other side of it. And so, any government anywhere has to have a position about the way that Europe is developing in the wake of the not yet solved Eurozone crisis. And particularly Britain, which is half in and half out of Europe anyway, has to respond to the intensification of a union that's going on now.
I think it's all those things. I think it's also possibly a fear of being outflanked by Labour. There was a bit of talk, of excitable talk, in the last few months about whether Labour might actually promise an in-out referendum from a, you know, pro-European, let's stop this nonsense once and for all kind of perspective. And that would have been the worst of all worlds for Cameron, to be, you know, embarrassed into a referendum by the Labour Party. But every time he talks about it now, I mean, watching PMQs and watching him being basically knocked around the park by Ed Miliband over this, he looks, every time he talks about referendum now, he looks like sort of the embarrassed guy at a strip club who was kind of dragged there by sort of their workmates. And, you know, yeah, they like looking at naked ladies, but it's just also tacky and it's going to cost a fortune and they're worried about what people think of them and, frankly, rather be home in bed with a good book. The instincts would absolutely be to repatriate powers from Europe, to have a, so to play a more minimal role. His instincts are Eurosceptic, but it's almost, you know, now he's PM, there's an economy to sort out, there's a coalition to keep together, all of this is just going to suck the oxygen out of politics for years, and he's been forced into offering something that actually, you know, by inclination he might have quite happily wanted to have in other circumstances. And that's a peculiarly awkward position for a prime minister to be in. And that's what you could see in PMQs yesterday, a real feeling of, you know, almost embarrassment and frustration at the position he's in, at being seen to be a prisoner of his own party. That's not a good look for a prime minister.
Dear, oh dear. So take us out of the strip club, Sundar.
Please take us out of the strip club. I've lowered the tone.
I mean, isn't the real problem here that he's sort of talking about a referendum and he's got nothing that he actually wants to refer? What's the proposition? That's the problem, isn't it? What's the question?
I think that remains quite complicated, but one of the reasons it's complicated is the external context is quite important too. And the external context is the reason that he can't avoid the domestic political issue. It's the reason he's been dragged to the strip club without wanting to go back there too quickly, because the European Union is going to change in very significant ways. The Eurozone is going to change in very significant ways. That isn't something that Britain is going to be part of. So what we are going to be part of is actually quite unclear. So we could talk about whether we want to be in or out, and we could also fall at least halfway out as well if we don't talk about it. So in the end, any prime minister has to resolve the issue. Actually, Cameron's trying to quite awkwardly, I think, hold the centre, because he's actually going to end up being the sort of pro-European voice within his own party debate, saying, in the end, I'm looking for the best deal for Britain and the way in which we stay in. And the pressure will come from people who think that he's risking our membership, but the pressure will come quite strongly from people who are thinking he's not asking the question honestly about whether we might want to be in or out.
But there is a really deep confusion, isn't there, Martin? I mean, because Harold Wilson had his referendum in 1975. I mean, people said it was a bit of a sham. He renegotiated terms, not in a big way, and then said, no, they're good enough, I'm going to get you to endorse these. But the strategy here from a large part of the Conservative Party seems to be have a referendum first so that you can then strengthen your hand in some negotiations later.
Well, that's certainly what some in the Conservative Party, like David Davis, are pressing for. It may be foreshadowed in what Cameron says tomorrow. People listening to this podcast later in its life cycle will know what Cameron's going to say. We, at the moment, don't know exactly what he's going to say and exactly how he puts the referendum question and what options he leaves open. That's one of the issues that's been most fought over right down to the wire. So, you know, we don't know on that. What I think we can say is two things. One is, I think that in the short term, whatever he says about a referendum, Cameron's going to get quite a boost from this. I think it's going to be quite an effective play. And, you know, the Tories are going to go up in the polls a bit, rather like they did last time Cameron made a big play on Europe back in December 2011 at Brussels when he had the veto. But as in that case, I think it may ebb away again. Now, the second thing that I think is really worth saying in this context is that you mentioned 1975. The striking thing that happened in public opinion in 1975 was that a few months before the referendum took place, there was overwhelming support for getting out of Europe. Once the debate started, a status quo momentum grew very powerfully, and which Wilson was able to capitalise on. And in the end, we stayed in by 2-1, almost a direct reverse of where public opinion was a few months before. You can see something similar to that going on in public opinion at the moment. If you look at the, I think it was a YouGov poll in the Sunday Times at the start of this week, something similar is happening. Support for staying in the EU has been growing over the last few months, which might seem counterintuitive in the context of a growing clamour for a referendum and getting out. But actually, it may well be that Cameron is in the right place by saying, you know, we want to stay in with this and that change. The problem is, will what he presents be plausible enough to hold the Tory party together?
Gabby, 1975, it's an interesting precedent, and it might suggest that all the pro-Europeans have got nothing to worry about. But that was just before punk rock, wasn't it? Were people more disobedient to what the political establishment tells them to think now, do you think?
I'm not sure that punk rock is going to be the deciding factor here. But yeah, it's very important that then it was very much a politician-led campaign. I think now politicians are held in, shall we say politely, somewhat less high regard than they were in the 1970s. It'd be very important that it's not just a politician-led campaign. You know, it's going to involve business. It's going to involve figures who are more attractive to the electorate. But I think, I mean, Martin's right, I think, that Cameron is actually, you forget how badly it came across yesterday, Cameron is actually in the populist position, and I think, which is saying grumbling about Europe but staying in Europe, a peculiarly British compromise of wanting to hate Europe but actually being afraid of walking away. And there was a Comres poll not that long ago which showed really, I mean, if you ask people, do you think membership is a costly mistake? Yes. Do you think there are more disadvantages than benefits to belonging? Yes. Do you want to leave then? No. And actually, Cameron is articulating that position sort of quite well, and that's always a good position to be in, and it's going to be quite a hard position for Labour to argue against. But that said, I mean, it all hinges on being able to deliver what people say they want, which is a more sort of minimalist role in Europe, but not actually having to leave. Say that we try and have that negotiation and we fail and we come away with stuff all. You know, you're then going into a referendum saying, OK, we wanted to get this deal, but we haven't. And anyway, this is a referendum now. What exactly? On our competence as a negotiator? I mean, it's not good that this speech setting out how brilliantly we're going to renegotiate our relationship with Europe, you know, he hasn't even been able to have it on the day he wanted because the Germans said no. I mean, if you can't even sort of settle, can't even negotiate the date on which you make your speech about renegotiating, it doesn't augur tremendously well for your ability to kind of walk away with this fantastic deal.
But Gabby, I want to turn to Labour in a second, but firstly, just on the coalition, because obviously the Liberal Democrats are on the other side of the aisle on this one. In the past, this has been one of those issues that can cripple and come to dominate government. Do you think they both know that they're different and they'll be able to muddle through politely while saying opposing things? Or do you think it's really going to
get incredibly complicated? And you can see it even now, almost less between the coalition partners, because you kind of know where Clegg is going to be, you kind of know where Cameron is going to be, you kind of know where Cable is going to be. But every single cabinet minister who's been interviewed about this seems to have a slightly different position than the others. You know, there are shades of opinion across the Tory members of the coalition, never mind the Liberal Democrat members of the coalition. And the pattern we've seen in the past is that you expect the problems in the coalition all to be between Tories and Lib Dems, but actually some of the worst of the fighting has been kind of blue on blue. So I think the problem is going to be a cacophony of voices generally, not just that the coalition itself is split on these things. I think probably people can understand that two different parties went into coalition with different views, and sometimes they're going to take different views on an issue. They kind of get that. But they don't want to hear 47 views on the same issue from within one party.
All of that makes some space for Ed Miliband to, as you referred to earlier, have a bit of fun this week.
I am talking about the substance. His position appears to be this. An in-out referendum now would be destabilising, but promising one in 5 years' time is just fine for the country. Now, let's see if that is his position, because what does that mean? That is 5 years of businesses seeing a closed for business sign hanging around Britain. What did Lord Heseltine say? He said this. To commit, I know they want to jeer Lord Heseltine, one of the few mainstream voices in the Conservative Party. He said this. To commit to a referendum about a negotiation that hasn't begun, on a timescale you cannot predict, on an outcome that's unknown, seems to me like an unnecessary gamble. Isn't Lord Heseltine right?
And so, Sundar, where do you think all this leaves Labour?
Yeah, I think they're in quite a puzzling position, actually. I think while Cameron is in some difficulty with his own party, I think he's massively helped in the short term by the position the Labour Party has taken, because it will allow the Conservatives, instead of saying, did he offer us enough, to put the contrast between the Prime Minister, who will offer some sort of vote, and the Labour Party now holding the line against it. One thing I think that's surprising is that I don't think that's going to hold as a Labour position, certainly through 2014 and the European elections, which everybody thinks UKIP will win, elections which people don't know what they're about. It's a free protest vote and people will use it. So I think that pro-Europeans will need to voice the confidence that Martin was just voicing about, that they can secure consent for membership. And I think a pro-European argument, I think, that can't do that actually will get nowhere, because it will play to its worst stereotypes. There's a sort of sense with the pro-European argument at the moment that it sort of went missing in action for 15 years, was put in suspended animation in about 1999, and has come back with exactly the same people saying exactly the same things, as if nothing's changed at all in Europe. And it really, I think, needs to develop more confidence that if this is in our national interest, then you have to secure the consent of people at some point, because it's changing a lot. And we do now have referenda in our political culture on issues that are about the rules of the game.
And yet, if Labour says we're going to have a referendum, and you can see, I think, why Douglas Alexander and Ed Miliband are nervous, Martin, because that would dominate the first term, potentially, of a prospective Miliband government, wouldn't it?
Well, I think, you know, Labour is in a difficult position on a lot of things, not just on Europe. It's fundamentally, it's on a in a difficult position about the economy, but it knows very well that it stands or falls, its prospects of getting back into power in 2015 do stand or fall by whether it's got a credible economic strategy. And, you know, that is the thing that's the precious vase that they're trying to carry across this marble floor and not drop. And that is the thing that matters most from their point of view. And that's why they don't want to, I think, get sidetracked into that. I mean, if you just think it through, if Labour comes to power in 2015, it's not very likely to come to power with a huge Blair-style 1997 majority. It'll come in with either a really quite small majority, or it will be the largest single party in another hung parliament, and there'll be a debate then as to whether it will govern as a minority government or in some form of coalition. And whatever the outcome, it's going to be a much more fragile Labour government than we used to from the Blair years. And so, I mean, we're going to have to, Labour's going to have to take difficult choices about priorities. Otherwise, it's going to be blown off course very, very quickly. And, you know, that's happened in the past and it could happen here. And assuming that the Tories are out of power in 2015, imagine what kind of a Tory leadership contest there might be in 2015. I mean, the Eurosceptic, being more Eurosceptic than now will be the key thing there. And what Gabby was talking about a little while ago in terms of, you know, different cabinet ministers saying different things, that's all got to be seen to some extent in the context of a prospective leadership election in the event of a Tory defeat. So, you know, it's very, very difficult. I think Labour in the end would like to have a referendum. I think Miliband would like to do a Wilson and come back at some point within the 2015 to 2020 Parliament with a referendum, win it and kill the issue off for a bit. But Sunder's entirely right. You know, there are big, big problematic issues that have got to be addressed before he can do that.
Well, you can read more thoughts from Martin on Labour in Europe and comment. It's free website. And you can also keep up with what the Prime Minister actually says rather than what he might say on Friday on the Guardian Politics website, guardian.co.uk/politics. But for now, according to a new report, nearly 60% of Britons describe themselves as working class, including a third of top earners. And the issue that tops the table of concerns at the moment is immigration. It also found that while people are still largely pessimistic about their prospects for the year, they're less pessimistic than they were. So, Sunder, this is your think tank's report, The State of the Nation. And I got the sense you're trying to find some little reasons to be cheerful in hard times.
Well, we called it Bittersweet Britain because both things are true. People are optimistic about the year ahead for their families and their local areas. They're pessimistic about the state of the nation and the country being on the wrong track and the economy. Less pessimistic significantly about the economy than they were a year ago, which is possibly coming out of recession as much as the Olympic factor. Strong sense of sort of national pride, two-thirds of people saying they'd rather be British than anything else, and divisions about whether on the right track and the wrong track, big worries about immigration and inequality and contribution. So a real sense of a sort of society where people are looking for the things that bring them together. Big pride in the National Health Service, which came top here ahead of the Olympics and the monarchy, worried about the things that divide them. In a way, the issue is how do you put those most difficult conversations on the table in a way where we might have a constructive response to them, not a sort of polarised one that makes them worse.
And although you say people in general are more optimistic about, you know, their family, their community than what's happening to Britain, as you read about in the paper and get the screaming bad news headlines, in the last year, it looks like the pessimistic quotient in terms of your own family, your own town has gone up.
Yeah, and it is a mixed picture. And the other thing that's mixed is it's quite divided across the country. Actually, immigrants the most optimistic of all and think the country's on the right track. So if George Osborne wants people who understand what he's doing, maybe he needs to think about that. But a lot more confidence in the southeast of England and a lot of pessimism in the northeast and in Wales and on a class basis. And you're a lot more confident if you've got a degree. So these aren't deeply surprising things. So a sense that people want things that bring them together, but actually quite a fracturing as to who thinks that, you know, when we get through, we'll still be OK. And the people who think that the cracks will be so bad that, you know, will be damaged for years and years to come. Basically, the worse off you are now, the more you fear that the damage of this crunch is going to be really quite severe for Britain in the long term.
So not that surprising, Gabby, but you've been looking at the bit on class.
I have, yes. I was just really struck by that sense of, you know, the people who now see themselves as working. I mean, even almost half of people who would normally be defined as ABC1 saying that they actually define themselves as working class. I mean, what is that about? You're a middle manager who thinks you're really a sort of horny-handed son of toil. And I think that speaks to a sort of greater confusion, really, about where we all stand vis-a-vis other people, and about, I mean, people, I think, don't anymore necessarily define their class by what they do, which used to be the old way of doing it. You know, your occupation defined your class, or maybe your parents' occupation defined your class. It's not like that anymore. I think people define it more as a sort of emotional state. So if you feel secure and comfortably off and, you know, quite confident about the future and a bit smug, you know, then you're middle class. And if you feel anxious and like you're constantly short of money and not really sure and scrabbling around to pay the bills and that things are slipping away from you, then you feel working class, even if your income and your profession are not working class. And it felt to me as if that sort of really speaks to people just feeling worse off rather than necessarily feeling that they've technically slid back down the ladder.
I mean, it could be, couldn't it, that, you know, some of the reports we were seeing before Christmas about, for men in particular, years on end now, even before the recession, when their pay packets have been stuck and they've not had any pay rise, maybe even if you're, you know, three quarters of the way up the ladder, but you're not feeling ever that you're getting any better off.
You don't feel like you've got a middle class lifestyle, even if you are technically middle class, because, you know, things that you would expect to be able to afford relatively easily feel like they're sort of slipping out of your grasp, you know. And if you define your class almost by what you consume or what you own or the things you have or the assets you feel, I mean, most people would have said that middle class people, for example, buy their, you know, own their own homes. They don't live in rented flats. They're able to build, own their own homes. Well, given that the age of the average first time buyer is now, what, 37? You don't have a whopping great deposit from your parents. There are a lot of people who would traditionally think of themselves who would conventionally be middle class, but are in that position of not being able to afford to buy. And that changes your sense, I think, of where you are. You don't feel that you're sort of comfortably in the swim of things, middle of the road. You feel like you're dropping down the ladder.
Martin, there was we've become familiar now with this idea that this great tide of home ownership that people have talked about since before the Second World War, an unstoppable tide, has stopped and gone into reverse. There's more people in the most recent census who are renting than there were 10 years before. And I saw something last week about the other great marker of being middle class, more education, being questioned, that there's going to be new ways into some professions now, which involve, you know, learning on the job rather than more years of formal education. This idea that we're all middle class now, do you think it's falling victims to hard times?
In some ways, yes. I think what Gabby was talking about is a sense of powerlessness. And I think people right up and down the income scale, to a very high degree up the income scale, do have a feeling that they are victims in this situation, this global economic shakedown that's going on, and have a feeling that that's not going to change anytime very soon. And they're probably right. And at the same time, we don't really have the old kinds of institutions of solidarity or cultures of solidarity that we were familiar with from the Industrial Revolution and in the 20th century. People do cling to concepts like, not just concepts, the realities of things like the National Health Service, you know, even though it's in a highly problematic and fluid and difficult state in those circumstances. So I think middle classism remains where most people would like to be in this, more people in this country than anywhere else. But it's under attack. Obviously, it's under attack. So, but I'm not entirely sure that the old, well, I am pretty sure that the old solutions to that are not the new solutions. I don't think we're going to get, for example, a massive growth of large labour-based trade unions as the kind of institutions of solidarity. But what we might get is, at a smaller scale, quite a lot of things, you know, the revival of mutuals and so on and so forth. Those sorts of forms of security, I think, are very interesting.
Sunder, how does, like, this idea of people being stronger together, wanting to be together but not being able to. How does that play out in a more diverse society? I mean, there's a big argument going on at the moment about what happens when we get more immigrants next year from Bulgaria and Romania. Do you think that undermines potentially some of the old ways of solidarity that Martin's talking about?
I think that's one of the reasons people worry about it. It's one of the reasons, comes out in this report, immigration worries people as a national issue much more than it does as a local issue. They're just as worried about it as a local issue in Wales and the North East as they are in London. And that's very steady across the country. As a national issue, that's have people got a grip on the system? Does it work? What's our national identity about? But what also came out here was quite a common sense and perhaps quite liberal view of integration. If there are very robust foundations for integration, if people don't speak the language and want to play by the rules, then they're never going to get off the starting line. But a majority of people then say, within those bounds of common citizenship, your own culture deserves respect. Children of immigrants should make the mix and the balances that they want. So a real sense about what the foundations are, but quite a liberal sense. So people very worried about segregation of schools, but absolutely reject by 4-1 cricket tests and so on. So a real sense of a liberal society needs some common bounds, but a liberal society says choose for yourself once you've got the basic things that you need to share.
Now, it may not be dominating the headlines here, but one place where there's very deep segregation and pitch battles are playing out is on the streets of Belfast. They're continuing these pitch battles into a second consecutive month, following a controversial council decision last year to limit the number of days that the Union flag will fly above the town hall. I asked our Ireland correspondent, Henry MacDonald, for a summary of what's happened since.
This dispute started in early December when Belfast City Council ended the policy of flying the Union flag on top of Belfast City Hall 365 days in the year. In fact, the nationalist councillors on the council wanted to stop flying the flag completely. However, the Alliance Party, it's the non-sectarian Liberal Party, linked to the Liberal Democrats, holds the balance of power between unionism and nationalism at City Hall. They forced through a compromise motion which would lead the Union flag only being flown on designated days. For instance, the Queen's birthdays, the birthday of Kate Middleton recently, even St Patrick's Day, in fact, it will fly 18 days in total. But this was not enough for a lot of loyalists who saw it as some kind of a slippery slope towards hollowing out British culture in Belfast. They had a lot of protests and roadblocks, but this soon degenerated into rioting in working class Protestant areas, and we've now had 40 plus nights and 40 plus days of a very violent disorder at times, and you know, over 100 people arrested and something like up to 80 police officers injured. It is being organised on social media. It's a good example of the role of Facebook and Twitter in street activism, if you like. Now, to say it's not organised completely would be wrong. There are people in there trying to exploit it, very extreme loyalist elements who are opposed to power sharing, who don't like the current political arrangement. They don't have much power politically, but they are influencing a lot of the young people who are out there. In addition, there are some loyalist paramilitaries involved. Now, loyalist terror groups are very fragmented, even during the Troubles. And what you have really is one particular group in East Belfast who are involved in the violence. They're involved for their own naked gain. They have been the subject of police investigations into crime and stuff like that, and criminal assets. And they're using this, I suspect, to put pressure on the state to leave them alone. You know, we'll stop being quiet. We'll lower the temperature if you take your eye off us, vis-a-vis what we own, such as pubs and other assets. So it's an amalgam of different interest groups who've coalesced around this issue of the flag. Now, in relation to the politics of the situation, I think it's been very poisonous. There's a lot of rancor, even at the level of the Northern Ireland Assembly. You had a Sinn Féin member saying he understood why nationalist residents in the Short Strand area of East Belfast would throw stones at the loyalists. This caused outrage in the Assembly on Monday. It is having an impact on politics, and it is really making a kind of a toxic atmosphere, so not good at the start of this new year. If, for example, there was some extraneous event, let's say, God forbid, a teenager, because some of these teenagers are very young involved in this rioting, was to be injured by a police Land Rover or a plastic batten round or something, and suddenly this disparate group of forces that are involved in this protest or suddenly to have a martyr to coalesce around them, that could change the game. And I was talking to old veteran loyalist paramilitaries who are looking on in dismay at this. They see the folly of this. And one of them, who's been around a long time and I've known a long time, who is very much a peace processor, said to me, the last thing we need is a martyr on these streets. And that's the kind of thing that everyone's looking out for and hoping can be avoided.
Sunder, I mean, it makes Britain look like a model of multicultural harmony, doesn't it?
I think the scale of the division is worrying. It's also sad, I think, in the year that we've had in across, you know, Great Britain, and the way in which we saw the way in which the Union flag has become so much more inclusive than it was 20 or 30 years ago, when you had sort of slogans about, you know, send them back with the Union flag, that it's still such a source of division. And I think what's playing out there is the sense of what happened after the Good Friday Agreement. Was it good for both communities? There was a story about mutual respect of the different communities. There was a lot of progress on that, if you think about the way, you know, Martin McGuinness shook hands with the Queen and so on. But that's really still very fractured, very, very polarised. And the big question in Northern Irish politics is how what appears to be majority opinion, that people would like less segregation, more integration, and to sort of move along from the, you know, very stark divides. How does that ever get a voice, actually, in a political system that's so trenchantly organised around the division, you know, the divided identities that people have?
Is that your reading of it too, Gabby, that institutions are getting in the way of goodwill, if you like, segregation?
I think it's more complicated than that. I think it's sort of more or less complicated that in a way. It's never just about the flag, is it? That's just a symbol of what, something to cling on to that articulates a much wider sense of abandonment, I think. It's a working class Protestant community feeling that, you know, the mainland is slipping away from them. They're not interested in them anymore. If you look at what's happened to Belfast, I mean, the unemployment rate in Belfast doubled in 3 years. Okay, from a very low starting point, but Northern Ireland was in some ways even more of a boom economy than we were in the boom times, because it had all the money sort of flowing in from the peace dividend and lots of sort of investment to make the new political deal work and so on and so on. And then it's been hit on both sides, dragged down by the economic collapse south of the border and dragged down by the mainland. And it's in a very sort of tough place economically. And traditionally, when populations are in a tough place economically, you know, you get unrest. And in this case, that's fueled by all the old sectarian divides. And partly, I think, also by, if you look at the age of the kids who are out on the streets rioting, they're not old enough to remember what the Troubles were actually like. They don't have that sort of natural break that their parents have of thinking, no matter how bad things get, we're not going back there. They don't have that sort of visceral memory of what it was like back there. And that, I think, is the political challenge, is how do you talk to sort of a generation of under 20s, under 25s, who sort of don't approach, are not as desperate to hang on to peace at all costs as the older generation is. And I think you also have to think about that sense of abandonment is partly sort of politically true. If you think about how much Northern Ireland used to consume British politics, and actually, you know, a fair amount of White House time too, the calibre of people who used to get put in the Northern Ireland office, you know, now it's a kind of backwater where you park not terribly good ministers, and it's very rarely discussed in sort of mainstream British politics. There is a feeling that kind of, yeah, we've done that, done Northern Ireland, it's kind of over now. And I think there is a reaction against that, and I'm not surprised.
It's also, Martin, the case, isn't it, that it used to be there was mainland British politics and then there was Northern Irish, but now it's also different in Wales and in Scotland. It kind of feels like London has just written off lots of its own, what used to think of as its own country, as other countries.
Well, I certainly think that is true, and I think there is a kind of closing of the mind in London to the rest of the country, not just to Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales, but also to Northern England. And a sense of, you know, everything that happens in the country that matters happens in London. And that's not true. And so I think, you know, these communities do feel abandoned. I think Northern Ireland's a bit of a special case because it is such a segregated society, and all the institutions of segregation remain. Literally, the walls have not come down in Belfast. And so, you know, it's not an integrated multicultural environment in the sense that we celebrated last year during the Olympics in the rest of Britain, and even as between Scotland and England and Wales, it remains a heavily segregated society. And in, you know, as in a sense, there is a The argument as to who wins in Northern Ireland has not yet been put to bed, because there is not an embrace of a Northern Ireland identity, even though it's growing. If you look at the polling in Northern Ireland, quite interestingly, about 20% of people in Northern Ireland now think of themselves as Northern Irish, and that was more than it's ever been in recent polling, where on the whole people have been divided between those who think of themselves as nationalists, i.e., basically wanting to be part of the Republic, or British, loyalist, British, part of Great Britain. So, I mean, things are changing there, but they're not changing fast enough to resist the kind of conflicts that have been created over the flag in a time of economic hardship.
Well, there's at least a hopeful glimmer to finish on after a discussion which is largely focused on abandonment. And we're going to abandon all of you now, dear listeners. So my thanks to Martin Kettle, to Gabby Hinsliff, to Sundar Cutwalla, and to Henry MacDonald, who we heard from before. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition: Mali, high stakes in Hollande's war, Johnny Margot solo, and our audiobook review looks at Christopher Priest's The Islanders and Daniel Defoe's classic Robinson Crusoe. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.